mention Mirat Hashem next week. There will be a shiur. It will be the last shiur of the series. The week after, we'll take a break for a month or so. Details to follow. We'll minimize details as much as possible for the time being. All we need to know is that next week there will be a shiur, and we'll find out next week when the break will be. So this week, we conclude Chumash Bamidbar. We have Parshas Maaseh by itself. And Maaseh, of course, true to its name, begins with Maaseh B'nai Yisrael, the journeys of B'nai Yisrael. And the Torah details them in 42 places, which gives us 41 journeys. And Maaseh B'nai Yisrael, as far as numbers of psukim are concerned, makes up about a third of the parsha. Vayisu from here, Vayachanu here. One gets into the rhythm. And of course, the question that all the Mefarshim are wondering is, why is the Torah telling us about all of these journeys, about all of these Nesios, Vayisu, Vayachanu? Indeed, there are certain places and certain Masaos that are mentioned here in Parshas Maaseh, looking back, so to speak, which are not even mentioned in real time. That is to say, in the Chumash, Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar, we don't hear about all of these 41. We hear about a good number of them. But here they are all together. What is the Torah teaching us by recording for us these 42 places? And, of course, there are a number of answers with a variety of different approaches. And Rashi opens the question for us. Lama nichtavu hamasos halalum? Why are these journeys written? And Rashi gives two perushim, and we'll see the first one this evening from Rashi. It's from Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. Lahudia chasodov shel mokum. It's in order for us to appreciate and to tell us the kindness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How so? Where is the kindness? She'afopi she'gazar aleihem letaltalam ulahaniyam bamidbar. Even though there was a decree, the reference, of course, is to the decree in the wake of the Chet HaMeraglim, that we would be wandering around in the desert. That was the punishment, so to speak. Lo tomar, one can only imagine, says Rashi, if they're wandering around, that means every sheni v'chamishi, they'll be moving again, and they'll never have a moment's rest. Lo tomar, don't think or don't imagine that they were traveling constantly and never had any rest. Not so. It's to this end the Torah tells you exactly how many times they traveled. For in total here there are only 42 places. And moreover, because they were 14 of these 42 actually were journeys that we had before the Chet HaMeraglim, before we got to Midbar Paran, which is from where the Meraglim were sent, which leaves a total of a remainder of 28. And Rashi goes on to say that the final eight were even in year 40 as we approached Eretz Yisrael. That leaves us with 20 over 38 years, which is not bad. That's the moral of the story. As if to say, the Torah is telling us, look how, not how many times they traveled, but how few times they traveled. Relatively speaking, it's not that much. 20, when you make the cheshbon, for 38 years, they were not constantly on the move, and the decree, therefore, did not treat them too harshly. That's Rashi in the name of Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. And there are a number of questions on this approach of Rashi, the straightforward questions. If indeed the goal of telling us these 42 places is for us to realize just how little they traveled, why does the Torah tell us all the places and then leave us to conclude that there were not really that many? Why would the Torah not say over the space of one or two psukim that they didn't really travel that much? Which is explicit. One could say that by telling us the names of the places, the message is given over from a slightly different angle, and maybe it reaches a different part of the person when you see the places and you see for yourself that there really weren't that many. But I wonder if one may say that when you hear this rather long list of places, I wonder whether the impression is, oh, there were so few of them. When you hear them all together, it may even give the opposite impression, that there were so many of them, and they just seem to go on and on. It's true, if you take a step back and spread it out over 40 years and start to make the cheshbon, it's really not that many, but the Kriyas HaTorah doesn't take 40 years. It takes 2 minutes. And in that space of time, you've got a lot of places. So it's interesting to consider whether the impression that comes out from the listing off of all these places is how few they were, or maybe there seems to be a lot of them, until what puts it over 40 years. Secondly, I mean, Rashi himself tells us that of these 42 places, 14 of them were before the Chet HaMeraglim. Now that should make a big difference, because we're no longer talking about 42 over 40 years, we're talking about 28. And that's before we get to lop off the final 8 in year number 40. But if the goal is to impress upon us the kindness that even though there was a decree that we should be wandering around, we didn't wander that much, why does the Torah add in the first 14 without signposting them? So I almost, you know, if I don't know and if I'm not alert, it just seems like there's another 14, but they're not part of the decree of the Meraglim. Why would the Torah mention them? Why would the Torah not just begin with where we were at the Chet of the Meraglim and where we ended up in year 40, which would only be 20 places? So from 20, it more than doubles to 42, and you need to be, again, alert to know to siphon off the first 14 and the last 8, and you're left with 20. It doesn't look like 20. And a very interesting question is raised by the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh. For let's just have a look at these 20. After all, 20. What's 20 encampments between friends? There's 38 years between year 2 and year 40, and 20 is not a lot. Says Maharal, well, it depends how long each journey took. If it took 2 days, it's not a lot. If it took 6 months, it is a lot. So it doesn't tell us the whole story just by telling us the number of journeys. You need to know how long they were, because if they took a long time, we may yet have spent a good deal of time in transit. And this we don't know. So these are some of the basic questions that are raised by Mefarshei Rashi, and a great deal to ponder there. But nonetheless, this is Rashi's first offering in the name of Rabbi Moshe Adarshan, Lodia Chasodov Shel Makom. The Rambam also addresses the question as to why the Torah tells us in details for us, names all of the 42 Masa'os. This is in the Mor Nevuchim in Chelek Gimel, Perek Nun. It's within the context of a broader discussion about certain sections of the Torah that seem to be technical or logistical. How do they help us in our Yiddishkeit? That's really what the Rambam is discussing there. And with regards to our question, the Rambam explains that the Torah tells us where the Bnei Yisrael encamped, and place by place, in order to emphasize the nisim, the miracles that accompanied us in the Midbar. We know, in a general sense, that we were in the Midbar for 40 years, and one can't really survive in the Midbar, which if Hashem kept us going, it must have been a miracle. However, says Rambam, there is different types of deserts. Some deserts are traveler-friendly, and some are forbidden. Some are, they're technically the desert, but they're near enough to civilization that one can get what one needs. Or perhaps even if it's difficult to grow anything, but it is possible. I mean, we know deserts. I mean, we live in some of them. It can be worked with. And therefore, says Rambam, people may underestimate in future generations the enormity of the miracle of keeping the Jewish people sustained during this time. They may have thought we were in those deserts which were closer to civilization, and therefore people can get by. And that falls short drastically of what happened, because we were nowhere near civilization for much of the time. As indeed the psukim say, as Moshe Rabbeinu says, you're in a place where there's nothing, and the Bnei Yisrael complain about this. Lo makom zera, you can't grow anything here, there's nothing here, there's no water here, there's nothing. In order to emphasize this point, says the Rambam, the Torah tells us the names of the places, because these places are not anywhere near civilization. Now you know, they were mamish in the middle of nowhere, and the Jewish people survived purely on nisim. This is the explanation of the Rambam, to appreciate and to highlight the extent of the miracle. Know that these were harsh desert locations, not friendly desert locations. Now, with regards to this explanation of the Rambam as well, there are one or two questions. Firstly, again, we always need to weigh the message against the volume of psukim that give us the message. The point is, according to the Rambam, these places were not near civilization. They're in the middle of nowhere. The pasuk elsewhere tells us they're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, these are the psukim that the Rambam quotes. So, again, one may ask, why would the Torah not be content with those psukim which say that we were nowhere near any water, nothing could grow? What is added by telling us the names of these places? Especially as the Rambam says the Torah is sensitive for people who would almost willfully diminish and deny the extent of the miracle. Well, if they'll deny those psukim, they deny these ones as well. Denial is a force, and it's quite a capable one. And secondly, and this is raised almost obliquely by Rabbeinu Bachya in his introduction to his commentary on Parshas Maaseh, in order to get the point of the Torah according to the Rambam here, you need to know where these places are. Because when it says Vayusu Midafka, Vayachanu Ba'alush, Vayachanu Barisma, you need to know where those places are, because you need to know that, oh, those are places that they're completely nowhere near civilization. If you didn't know, so as far as you're concerned, it's all the same. I don't know that this is in the middle of nowhere. Maybe it's in the middle of somewhere. Maybe it's close to somewhere. So it's interesting, because it relies on a knowledge of where these places are, because otherwise it will be lost on you. And that's another interesting observation with regards to the Rambam. The Jewish people themselves were well aware of the miracle. It's really, let's say, for subsequent generations, one would almost need to preserve a Masorah as to how far away from civilization these places were in order for the point of the Torah to come across. But for us in 2014, and we go through the Psukim, we don't know where these places are. Are they nearby? Are they far? We don't know. Interestingly, by the way, it's parenthetically, if they're so far away from everywhere, then how do they have names? I mean, who called them that? No one ever goes there. But that is more likely part of the second idea, that a lot of these names are really connected to things that happened there, which is also then the question is, who knows about these names? If it's only the Jewish people, then the Jewish people were on board with the extent of the miracle anyway. So these are the observations with regards to the Rambam. But I wanted to mention as a third approach this evening the Sephorno, because he has such a different angle here, and it's Meshiv Nefesh. The Sephorno says, he comments briefly, as is his way, Eile Masa'ei, to the beginning of our Parsha, Rotza Hakel Yisparach, Sheyikosvu Masa'ei Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted that these journeys and these destinations, stations, should be written down. And indeed, Pasuk Beis stresses this when it says, Vayichtov Moshe es motzaeim lemasaehem al pi Hashem, which itself is highly unusual. The Torah tells us that Moshe wrote these things al pi Hashem. Everything that's in the Torah is al pi Hashem. And here, Moshe is writing al pi Hashem in the Torah that he wrote these things al pi Hashem. The Ramban notes that the Torah is going out of his way to emphasize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted these things to be in the Torah. Why? So far, if we could recap, for Rashi, it's Lehodia Chasodav Shel Makom, to remember Hashem's kindness. For Rambam, it's Lehodia Nisav Shel Makom, to remember the miracles. Says the Sforno, Lehodia Zechusam. It's to make known the merit of Bnei Yisrael. Why? Belechtam acharav b'midbar, Be'eretz Levzerua, which is a paraphrase from the Yirmiya, which is the Haftorah from last Shabbos, that they went after HaKadosh Baruch Hu into the middle of nowhere. Be'ofen Shehoi Ru'uyim Likanes La'aretz, in a way that made them then fitting and eligible and worthy to enter into Eretz Yisrael. According to the Sforno, the Torah, and one hears now the emphasis, the Torah details each and every journey that we took, because each subsequent journey is a subsequent merit. Lo'odia zechusam. And by the way, this will explain to us something very interesting, as is pointed out by the Sefer Shiras David. The Pasuk says, Eile ma'asei b'nei Yisrael, asher yotzu me'eretz Mitzrayim. These are the journeys of the Jewish people who left Mitzrayim. How did they leave? Who took them out? Well, Hashem took them out. What's the most appropriate way to refer to that? So we have an interesting discussion about this in Parshas Balak. Because when Balak originally sends his message to Bilam in the beginning of the Parsha, he says, Hinei am yatsa mi Mitzrayim. Okay. He doesn't say which nation. I think everybody knows which nation it is. But he says, Am Yatsami Mitzrayim. Now, as one part of one of the brachos and the nevuos that Balak then says about Bnei Yisrael, which is in Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Kaf Beis, he says, Kael Motziyam Mi Mitzrayim. Hashem is taking them out of Mitzrayim. And Rashi explains that part of what Bilam is doing is correcting Balak. He's setting the record straight. Ata amarta, says Rashi, hine am yatsami Mitzrayim. The people left Mitzrayim. That's not a way to talk about Yitzias Mitzrayim. They didn't just leave. Lo yatsami atmo, elo hutsiyom, elo kehem hutsiyom, Hashem took them out. It's very interesting. It's like a parenthetical Musar capsule for Balak. Yeah. So people just left, as if they just left. That's what type of talk is that? Kael motziyam b'mitzrayim. Hashem took them out. That's the way to talk about it. Very interesting. Because now we come to Parshas Maaseh, and that's how we talk about it. Eile Maaseh b'nei Yisrael, asher yotzu me'eretz Mitzrayim. We don't see Hashem took them out. We say they left. But isn't that how Balak said it? Didn't Bilam correct him? Why does the Torah talk about it that way? Says the Shiras David, according to the Sforno, you understand, because the goal of the Torah is to emphasize the merit of Bnei Yisrael. So we know Hashem took them out. But here the point is, but they were prepared to go. Hashem yatsu mimitzrayim. Lechtecha harba midbar. Be'eretz lo zeruah. And what's fascinating about the Sforno, aside from this whole new approach now to the beginning of Maaseh, each and every subsequent Vayisu Vayachanu is another praise being sung about the Bnei Yisrael. But it also means that Maaseh, which is the end of Chumash Bamidbar, concludes in praise of Yisrael. It's the way the Sefer is wrapped up. And that's very interesting, because the Sefer Bamidbar begins in praise of Bnei Yisrael. It begins with the counting of Bnei Yisrael. Rashi tells us Hashem loves the Bnei Yisrael, that's why he counts them. Mitoch chibosam nafonav, mona osam kol sha'a. So it begins in praise of Bnei Yisrael. It ends, Maaseh, in the same way, in praise of Bnei Yisrael. Why is that so important? It's important not only because it's always good to speak in praise of the Jewish people and of Jews within the Jewish people, but because, in a sense, it sets the background and the context for everything that happens in the middle of Sefer Bamidbar. Because Sefer Bamidbar, in a sense, contains within it many mishaps. It contains many blunders, many dark parshas. Sometimes it seems almost one after the other. They need to be prized apart. Kibra Satava, and Misonanim, and Meraglim, and it seems to keep on going. And therefore, it's crucial that the enduring portrait, presentation of the Torah of the Jewish people is positive. For in the yes or no of the matter, they are positive. They are Hashem's people, chosen for a reason. Do they make mistakes? Yes. But those mistakes don't define them. They set them back, and they had to overcome them. But they don't define them. What defines them is what happens at the beginning, at the end. The counting of Bnei Yisrael and the traveling of the Bnei Yisrael, each one in their own way reflecting the shvachim of Bnei Yisrael, That sets the tone for Chumash Bamidbar, against which everything else can be taken with a different measure of understanding. Pardon me. And there is a further point about Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar. I think that the Sforno revealed to us that we're familiar with the pasuk Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar. How far did that take us, and how long did it last? Our notion, I believe, is that when we left from Mitzrayim into the Midbar, that's Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar, and then we get used to it, and then the Jewish people, they're in the Midbar. But the Sforno says, no, don't get used to it. Every single time we followed Hashem in the Midbar was another notch, was another brick in the edifice of Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar. And the 42 Masoros were 42 levels of Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar. Especially as, in the words of the Sforno, through Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar, we became worthy of entering Eretz Yisrael. And what that means is, in light of the other shortcomings that we had on our way into Eretz Yisrael, we developed steadily. Each journey ingrained within us a further level of emunah, as expressed by Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar. And the culmination and the accumulation of those 42 journeys meant that we were finally connected enough to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to enter into Eretz Yisrael. So, essentially, the Sforno took the concept of Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar and he multiplied it by 42. It wasn't just a one thing that happened, and from here on it's business as usual. Every time we moved on, it was another deepening of our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I think that the enduring point, which is always fascinating, is that our time in the Midbar was hot and cold, in the sense that it was positive and negative at the same time, in the sense that there were episodes there which were setbacks, there were points there which were negative. But that said, what's happening underneath all of that is that we are developing as Hashem's people, Lech Techa Acharei Bamidbar. It's almost, in a sense, a reflection of our experiences in Mitzrayim itself, which was also good and bad for the Jews at the same time, even in spiritual terms. On the one hand, it's the smelting furnace, it's the Kur HaZahav, which apparently made us better and better. But on the other hand, the longer we stay, our spiritual level is going down lower and lower. So the question is, well, is Egypt good for the Jews or not? Are we getting better or are we getting worse? But the answer is yes, in the sense that behaviorally, the more we stay or exposed to the culture around us, it affects us. But on a much more fundamental level, our Jewishness is being consolidated by all the difficulties of Mitzrayim and by all of those experiences. So it's almost like on an external level, we're sustaining a good deal of trauma, but on a core level, it's developing us as the Jewish people. And the time in the Midbar seems quite similar, in that there were mistakes that were made, and if that's all there is to it, that our level goes down. But all the while, our level is actually on a more fundamental level going up as we develop in this basic emunah, and then everything else set against that can sort itself out. So these are the three, I would say, primary approaches in the Rishonim to understand the first third of Parshas Maaseh. Hashem's kindness for Bnei Yisrael, he didn't trouble them too much during those 38 years. The miracles that we were in the middle of nowhere, and Zchusim of Yisrael also, we are prepared to follow Hashem into the middle of nowhere time and again, and all that while it's building Judaism. As the Parsha continues, so we are introduced to the concept of Arei Miklat, and that's in the cities of refuge for the one who kills unintentionally. That's in Perek Lamed Hei. And there's a well-known discussion. It takes place more amongst the Acharonim. As we know, if someone unfortunately kills someone unintentionally, he's got to go to the Arei Miklat. Why? Why must he go? And here, there are two possibilities. They're quite different from each other. Could it be, as we know, the deceased, his victim, may have relatives, and they're entitled to a certain degree to kill him, unless he seeks refuge, that his asylum is in the Arei Miklat. And therefore, could it be that it's a matter of practicality? The Torah says, go to the Eir Miklat to save yourself, because if you're outside, you're at risk. So it's for the protection from the Goel Hadam, it's called, from the relatives of the one that he killed. Or could it be that aside, there's no question that is true, and there are halachas about that, but there's an essential reason to be going to the Eir Miklat. Even if you're not at risk, if you leave, it's important for you to be there. Somehow it helps you. Somehow it's a kapara for you. And there are sameach. We've discussed this actually in the past. But something that we didn't mention at the time, the Or Sameach, in his Perush Or Sameach on the Rambam, in Hilchos Rotzeach, he demonstrates that actually there is essential value for the Rotzeach, for the killer, to go to the Eir Miklat. It's not just to protect him from the Goel Hadam. He does so in a very interesting way. The beginning of Maseches Makos deals with a question of Edim Zomimim. It's a very interesting area of halacha. Edim Zomimim are witnesses, they testify about something, but it's later found out they weren't even there at the time. Other witnesses say that you were with us, you weren't even on the scene of the crime that you're testifying about. And the Torah famously says that whatever they sought to do to their victim is then done to them. Vasisem lo kasher zamam lasos la'achiv. And interestingly, within the very beginning of Maseches Makos, it's in the Mishnah, the question is, what happens if they testify that someone killed someone else by accident? Rotzeach bishkaga. And then it turns out that they are Edim Zomimim. Two other witnesses come along and say, how could you possibly say that? You were with us, and it's a classic case of Edim Zomimim. We're just about ready to say, well, you were about to send him to the Eir Miklat, so now you've got to go. What you wished on him will happen to you. That's how it goes. However, says the Mishnah, as explained by the Gemara, for various reasons we learn from a pasuk that doesn't happen. They don't go to the Eir Miklat. It's an anomaly. It's an exception to the rule. That's the teaching of the pasuk. Edom Zomim don't go to Eir Miklat. Says the Or Sameach, I have a simple question. If you were to understand that the entire purpose of the killer going to the Eir Miklat is to protect him from the brother of the person that he killed, if that's the be-all and end-all of going to the Eir Miklat, so why do I need a pasuk to teach me that these Edim Zomimim, who made up that someone killed someone else, that why should I think they should go to the Eir Miklat? They didn't kill anyone. There is no one who should be looking to kill them. I mean, the one they spoke about probably feels like he'd like to kill them. But there was no real murder. They didn't kill anyone, so there is no Goel Hadam. There should be no reason for them to go to the Eir Miklat, which means, of course they shouldn't go. I don't need a verse to go out of its way to teach me that they don't go. There's no reason for them to go in the first place. There's no victim. They made the whole thing up. If there's no victim, there's no Goel Hadam. And I still need to be told that they don't go? Yes, says Or Sameach. From here we see that there is more to going to the Eir Miklat than just, quote-unquote, protection from the relatives of the person that he killed. It's an essential aspect of kapara. One may have thought they need that kapara just like they always need to receive whatever they try to do. That's why I need a pasuk to tell you that it's different. And this begins the discussion of essential reasons for going to the Eir Miklat. And it's underscored, actually, by the fact, as the halacha states, we know that the killer, he stays in the Eir Miklat until the Kohen Gadol dies. Now, what if he dies before the Kohen Gadol? What if he dies in the Eir Miklat? Then what? So the halacha is he's buried in the Eir Miklat. And then when the Kohen Gadol dies, he can be reinterred if there's a family plot or something like that. It's a very interesting halacha, because one can certainly say that once he's dead, he's got nothing to fear from the Goel Hadam. So take him out straight away to bury him where you normally would. No. Even after he's no longer alive, still he stays in the Eir Miklat, which is just how far the kapara goes until the Kohen Gadol dies, then he can be reinterred. So this really demonstrates, again, very clearly, there is more to being in the Eir Miklat than just, quote-unquote, protection from the Goel Hadam. But the second factor that gives him kapara, which we've already mentioned, is the passing of the Kohen Gadol. As the pasuk itself says, "V'yoshav sham ad mos ha-kohen ha-gadol," he stays there until the kohen gadol dies. And what is behind that, the significance of that stage? Well, the Ralbag says very simply, Kohen Gadol represents the tzaddik of the generation, so he should. Misas tzaddikim mechaperas. And therefore his final stage of kapara comes with the passing of the Kohen Gadol. That's when his kapara is complete. But it's very interesting, as is pointed out by Mefarshim, because it turns out that if going to the Ir Miklat is a kapara, and the death of the Kohen Gadol is a kapara, it's a composite kapara. I mean, there are two factors that give him his kapara, which is a little bit unusual. Normally it's something. It's either a korban or a punishment or whatever it may be. But here the two go together. The Ir Miklat has its contribution, and the death of the Kohen Gadol has its contribution. Together they work to finish his kapara. It says Aruch Laner, in his Chidushim on Maseches Makos, it's analogous, loosely, to the situation where sometimes a person can bring more than one korban for a wrongdoing. If he's not sure if he needs to bring a korban, sometimes he brings what's called an asham talui, which is an interim kapara. And then if he subsequently finds out that he really did need to bring a korban, then he brings a chatas. So the Aruch Laner says it's almost like being in the Ir Miklat, it's like his asham talui. It's an interim kapara. It keeps him going, so to speak. And then the passing of the Kohen Gadol completes his kapara. That's his final kapara. But actually, as we say that there are two factors that bring about the kapara of this Rotzeach B'Shogeg, the accidental killer, namely being in Golus and the death of the Kohen Gadol, it seems from the Gemara that the principal kapara is the death of the Kohen Gadol, not being in the Ir Miklat. Ir Miklat, he's just in holding. It's the Asham Tali, as we said. But the primary kapara is the death of the Kohen Gadol. And the way that it comes out is because the halacha is, if he received a verdict that he needs to go to the Ir Miklat, what's called the Gemar Din, and they said, you're chayev, we've assessed the evidence, and you need to go. And he's chayev to go, and then the Kohen Gadol dies, before he even set foot in the Ir Miklat, he's exempt. He doesn't have to go. Because we see from here that, in a sense, being in the Ir Miklat is just protecting him, even spiritually, as long as the Kohen Gadol is still alive, until he passes away. But if the Kohen Gadol passed away before he even went, he doesn't go at all. So it really seems that the dominant mechaper is the passing of the Kohen Gadol. Now, this put many a Kohen Gadol in a rather uncomfortable position, because it means that there's a group of people who are essentially looking towards them, waiting for them to die. Because as soon as they do, they'll be free. So much so, the Mishnah says, amazingly in Maseches Makos, Imoseihem shel Kohanim, the mothers of the Kohanim, of the Kohen Gadol, hayu mesapgim lahem michya uksus, they used to take very good care of all of the people that were in the Ir Miklat. They made sure they'd send them packages and they'd send them food. Kidei shelo yispalu abaneim sheyamusu. They shouldn't spend their time. They've got plenty of time to reflect in the Ir Miklat. They've got plenty of time to daven also. And what's the thing they most want? That the Kohen Gadol should pass away. Because when he does, they're free. And therefore, the mothers were looking to endear themselves to these rotzchim so that they shouldn't do that. Now the Gemara says, well, just a moment. I mean, is it completely hefker? Let's say they will daven. Could they really cause him to die prematurely by davening? After all, it doesn't seem to be fair. It seems to be in the category of what's called kilelas chinam. It's a baseless curse. It's without basis. Says the Gemara, no, not exactly. It's possible that there is some basis, and maybe their tefillah will be received. Because on a certain level, it could be that the Kohen Gadol himself could have prevented their predicament. If he would have davened himself initially with more fervor, that there should be no such mishaps, after all, these are accidents and these are unintentional things. If he would daven for greater protection for the Jewish people and there should be no such incidents, perhaps they never would have killed unintentionally in the first place. Ad kedei kach. Now, they're not blaming him entirely. They go into Golus. He doesn't go into Golus. But nonetheless, you never know if that wasn't a factor. And if it is, maybe they're entitled to daven that he should die earlier. Ad kedei kach. So it's a very composite situation. But what's most amazing, when all is said and done, is that apparently the packages that the mothers sent worked. As if to say, you have these killers in the Ir Miklat. They're prone to daven that the Kohen Gadol should die as quickly as possible. The mothers are looking to counteract this by providing them with food and clothing. That's very nice, but it's not as nice as being free. So how were they successful? It's amazing. I mean, were they that good a cook that it's worth staying in the Ir Miklat just to have Mrs. Cohen's food? And then they end up not davening. So the Baalei HaMusar say, we understand we're in a highly unusual situation here, whereby they're davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take the Kohen Gadol away from the world prematurely. Now the chiddush is that can work, but one thing is for sure, it's not a standard prayer, it doesn't seem to be in the greater interest of the Jewish people, and in order for it to be effective, it will need 100% focus and intent. If that's chipped away by the cakes, then the tefillah doesn't have the potency that it needs, and it's left with hopefully being ineffectual. So it's very interesting, the shochad almost, the gain that they get, as slight as it is, it reduces slightly the absolute commitment of their tefillah, and then they can no longer expect that it will damage the Kohen Gadol. So these are some of the very interesting discussions about the Ir Miklat, about the role of the Ir Miklat, the role of Mrs. Kohen Gadol, and attendant matters. And from here, I'd like to move further towards the end of the Perek Lamed Hay, at Pasuk Lamed Dalet. And the perek is devoted to matters of killing, and of rotzeach, and what to do about it. And then it says, "Velo sitame es haaretz asher tumah minba." Do not contaminate. We know tumah means more than that. Spiritually, do not bring tumah into the land asher tem yoshvim ba, that where you dwell there, asher ani shochem besocha, where I dwell, namely Eretz Yisrael. Now, this is one of the final psukim, it is the final pasuk actually, about the chapter that deals with people that kill, whether on purpose or by accident. And we should know that Rishonim are divided as to what to make of this pasuk. What's the measure of this pasuk? And we'll explain. The Rambam, in Sefer HaMitzvos, begins, before he discusses the 613 mitzvahs, he prefaces with 14 shoroshim, that is to say, 14 criteria by which he will reckon and include something within the 613 mitzvahs. And in Shoresh Hay, criteria number 5, the Rambam says that sometimes the Torah will give you the reason for a mitzvah. The reason for a mitzvah is not itself a mitzvah. It's not going to be a separate category member of Taryag, of 613 mitzvahs. Obviously, it's not a mitzvah, it's a reason. The point is, says Rambam, sometimes the Torah writes the reason, it looks grammatically as if it's another prohibition, but it isn't. It's just the reason. And as if to say, if the Torah says don't do A and don't do B isn't a separate prohibition. It's telling you don't do A so that you shouldn't come to do B. It's the reason for A. If that sounds a bit abstract, a classic example would be, as the Torah says, with regards to the king, lo yar b'lo noshim, he shouldn't have too many wives. How many is too many? That depends on many things. But he shouldn't have too many. Why not? Says the pasuk, lo yar b'lo noshim, and then the pasuk says, v'lo yasur levavo. It shouldn't divert his heart from running the country, from being a good king. Now that's phrased as a separate prohibition. Lo yar b'lo noshim, v'lo yasur levavo. But the Rambam says, but it's not a separate prohibition. It's the explanation, the reason why he can't have too many wives, is so that, shelo yasur levavo. And therefore, says Rambam, one needs to be on the lookout. Sometimes the pasuk looks like a prohibition. It looks like it's a candidate for 613 mitzvahs. It's not. It's an explanation of the earlier prohibition. And a case in point, says Rambam, is our Pasuk, Pasuk Lamed Daled. For the Pasuk, the earlier Psukim have been talking about Lo Tidchu Kofel Nefesh Rotzeach, don't take ransom from a killer. If he's liable for whatever penalty it is, he can't buy it off with money. That's a prohibition. And then this Pasuk, Velo Sitameis Haaretz, is not a new prohibition. Don't contaminate the land. That's another Aveira? No. This is the explanation. This is the reason. As if to say, don't take ransom from a killer, because if you do, you will bring more tumah into the land. The killer needs to be dealt with. So Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Velo Sitameis Haaretz, is an explanation. It's the cause. It's the reason behind the earlier Psukim of not to allow him to get off the hook. The Ramban, however, in his critical commentary to the Sefer HaMitzvahs, his Hasogos to the Sefer HaMitzvahs, Ramban differs on, in this case, maybe not in principle of the Rama, but in this case, he says Pasuk Lamed Daled is a separate Isser. Velo Sitame Es Haaretz. Meaning, the Torah says you are not allowed ever to take ransom from a killer, to take money instead of the punishment you should get. And there is a separate prohibition in Eretz Yisrael. Because if in doing so one transgresses the further prohibition of contaminating the land by allowing such a thing to happen. It's a separate Isser. And moreover, says Ramban, it stands to reason that it's a separate Isser as opposed to being the underlying reason behind this, because Pasuk Lamed Daled is only in Eretz Yisrael. It almost sounds like there's only a problem of letting a killer go off the hook in Eretz Yisrael, but in Chutz Laaretz it's okay. If it's the reason behind it, which of course isn't true. And therefore, no, it's an additional prohibition, not dealing adequately with killers in Eretz Yisrael, it brings with it a separate prohibition over Lo Sitame Es Haaretz. Now, this is the classic machlokas in Parshanut, really, although it becomes a halachic machlokas between Rambam and Ramban. But the Meshech Chochma steps in and he broadens our scope a little bit. We've had a look at Pasuk Lamed Daled. It's the final Pasuk of the Perek. It says, Meshech Chochma, in my estimation, if you wish to get a full understanding of what this Pasuk Lamed Daled is doing, go back to Pasuk Lamed Aleph. For we will see that there are four Psukim in a row, and let's see how they are aligned one with the other. And this now is the approach of the Meshech Chochma. Pasuk Lamed Aleph says, Velo sikhu kofer lenefesh rotzeach ashehu rosh alamus. Do not take kofer, ransom. Don't allow him to buy off his crime. Who are we talking about? As the Pasuk says, rotzeach ashehu rosh alamus. Someone who should be killed for his killing, for his ritzicha. Namely, someone who killed intentionally. So Pasuk Lamed Aleph is about an intentional killer. Pasuk Lamed Beis repeats almost the same. Velo sikhu kofer, don't take ransom. Lanus al ir miklato, someone who needs to go to the ir miklat, don't allow him to buy that off with money. So Lamed Aleph and Lamed Beis are both prohibiting taking ransom, firstly to absolve himself from a chi of misa, and if it's on purpose, and secondly if it's unintentional for golus. That's Psukim Lamed Aleph and Lamed Beis. Now let's have a look at Lamed Gimel and Lamed Daled, because when we do, we will see that they respectively will explain Lamed Aleph and Lamed Beis. If Lamed Aleph and Lamed Beis were talking about intentional killer and unintentional respectively, Lamed Gimel and Lamed Daled will further bring out for the intentional and the unintentional. Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Velo sachanifu es haaretz, do not incriminate the land. Asher atem ba ki hadam hu yachanif es haaretz. That blood, that innocent blood, will incriminate the land. For la'aretz lo yuchupar ladam asher shupach ba ki medam shochvo. The land will not be expiated for until the blood of the killer is spilt. That's talking about an intentional murderer. Thus, Lamed Gimel is qualifying Lamed Aleph. That's why you can't take a ransom. He's got to be dealt with properly. And what about Lamed Daled? Velo sitame es haaretz now goes back to explain the unintentional killer. don't allow tumah to enter into the land, which will happen. Asher atem yoshvim ba, asher nishachem b'sochem. If Lamed Gimel qualifies the intentional killer of Lamed Aleph, then Lamed Dalet, do not contaminate the land, qualifies the unintentional killer of Lamed Beis. And this, says the Meshech Chochma, gives us insight into what is happening when someone kills someone else unintentionally. They bring tumah into the land. They haven't done a criminal act, but they bring tumah into the land. That tumah needs to be dealt with, and that's what the Ir Miklat is. In other words, where does a person go? This is an amazing perspective on Ir Miklat. Where does a person go when they're tamei? If the issue is one of tumah, what person needs to go to a mikveh to make themselves tahor? They need to go to a field of tahara, which the individual is the mikveh. Says the Meshech Chochma, the unintentional killer has brought tumah into the land. When he goes to the Ir Miklat, it's like he's going to the mikveh. He's got to go there and stay there. He's immersed there. That's his field of tahara. It accepts him and holds him. That's how he gets his tahara. And what's fascinating is the very beginning of Shas, the very first Mishnah, which deals with from when the Kohanim can eat their truma. Sometimes if a Kohen is tamei, even going to the mikveh is not enough. He's got to wait until the sun sets. Uva HaShemesh V'Taher. Which means that there are two component parts to his tahara. Number one, he goes into the mikveh. Number two, the sun sets. Says Meshech Chochma, amazingly, that's what happens with the Rotzeach. He's brought tumah into the land of Israel. And therefore, he needs to go to the Ir Miklat, which is the equivalent of the mikveh. And then he needs to wait. What's he waiting for? He's waiting for the passing of the Kohen Gadol. Because the passing of the Kohen Gadol is the setting of the sun for that generation. The Kohen Gadol is the light of his generation. And his passing is the setting of the sun. That corresponds to Uva HaShemesh V'Taher. Now he's pure, and now it can come out. So that's a really fascinating way of understanding how these two factors of Ir Miklat and Misas Kohen Gadol go together. Now, this Pasuk Lamed Dalet found its way into a very interesting discussion. We would never imagine, I don't think, that there would be a dispute about this, because we would forget for a moment that there's a dispute about everything. And if we come to Hilchos Brachos, the Brach of Alamichya, so at a certain point, as we know, Uvenei Yerushalayim HaKodesh, Meher B'Yameinu, Va'aleinu Nisacha, V'Samcheinu B'Vinyana, very nice, V'Nochal Mipriya, we should eat from its fruit, V'Nisba Mituva, and be satisfied from its goodness, from the Berech Allah, etc., and so forth. Everyone knows the Nusach of the Bracha. One of the Rishonim objected to this Nusach, and that is the Smag, the Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol. He objected to us saying that to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, V'nuchal mipriya v'nisba mituva, so we can eat of its fruits. Says the Smag, that's why you want to come back to Israel? To eat fruits? V'nisba mituva, misbo tuva. What is that? It sounds like a rather low-level ideal. Bring us back to Eretz Yisrael so we can have fruit there. V'nuchal mipriya. Now the truth is that his objection, it doesn't start with him, it's really reminiscent of the Gemara's discussion of Moshe in Masechah Sota, Daf Yud Daled, when the Gemara asks, really in this way, you hear the refrain of this phrase, Mipdimanis ava Moshe likanis le'eretz Yisrael, why does Moshe want to go into Eretz Yisrael? V'chilecho mipriya, v'lisba mituva, he wants to eat of its fruit, the Gemara asks rhetorically, no, it's to keep mitzvahs. So that's the first time this idea has been voiced. But really what the Smag is saying is that what the Gemara considered to be unacceptable as Moshe's motivation shouldn't ultimately be anyone's motivation. We may have thought, well, you know, we're not Moshe Rabbeinu, so for Moshe Rabbeinu it's mitzvahs, and for us, whatever there is. And so much so that the position of the Smag is not to say those words. And then, just those words should be deleted. Ad kedei kach. Now, what to make of such a charge? Well, the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, talks about this, and he defends including these words, we shouldn't be surprised to hear that in the end they will be in there because they're in every Siddur. But of course, the question was raised, how can you say that that's your motivation? Says the Beis Yosef, no, you need to have the right orientation to the bracha. It's not our motivation. But really understand that it's a means towards what we say afterwards. Because we say, v'nochal mipriya, v'nisbo mituva, unverechecha aleha. We'll bless you for all of that. As if to say, the objection to saying these words may be, if that's the end goal, that's the desired result, to eat the fruits of the land. That's it? No, that's not it. But don't leave it out. It's a platform. V'nochal mipriya, in order that, unverechecha aleha. It's a means towards the bracha. That's the defense of the Beis Yosef. Now we should know, there is a fascinating explanation of the nusach of this bracha, which is handed down from Reb Velbel Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, son of Reb Chaim. And he raises actually one or two more questions. We say, v'nochal mipriya, it's very interesting to look at these words. We say them the whole time. Unverechecha aleha b'kedusha uvetara. And we will bless you over it b'kedusha uvetara, in sanctity and purity. Says Reb Velbel Soloveitchik, where do we ever find a notion of making a bracha b'kedusha uvetara? I mean, it's not in a lexicon. Not that we object to it, but it's not. It's not a value that we're aware of. We never talk about it anywhere else. How should one make brachas? With kavona. Okay, but we don't say in a bracha la b'kavona. We say b'kedusha uvetara. Where is this idea coming from? Secondly, we say v'nochal mipirya. We will eat from its fruit. From what's fruit? What's the hay at the end? What's that qualifying? We may understand it's qualifying the land of Israel, the Nochal Mipriya. But actually, if we go back over the Nusach of the Bracha, we haven't mentioned the land of Israel that recently. For we say, Uvenei Yerushalayim, Ira Kodesh, Bimher B'Yameinu. The most recently mentioned feminine noun is Yerushalayim, which is feminine. And then we say, V'aleinu L'socha, bring us into it. Into what? Yerushalayim. Of and we'll eat the fruits of Yerushalayim, says the Velvel Soloveitchik. I didn't realize Yerushalayim was famous for its fruits. And moreover, there are halachas which bar growing fruit in Yerushalayim, because with all of the mess that goes with the agriculture, it's not matim for Yerushalayim. So there is no such concept as Pirya of Yerushalayim. But we talk about it, we say, V'nochal mipirya, uvenei Yerushalayim. What are the fruits of Yerushalayim? Says Reb Velbel Soloveitchik. It's a classic Brisk approach. He shines the light of Brisk onto this the bracha of Ala Michya. There is a type of fruit that you could call the fruits of Yerushalayim, because it's a type of fruit that can only be eaten in Yerushalayim. It's called Maaser Sheni. The second tithe. The first tithe goes to the Levi. The second tithe, in many years, one takes it to Yerushalayim. They come to Vali, so you go up and you bring it to Yerushalayim. Those are the fruits of Yerushalayim. The nochal mipriya, the fruits that can only be eaten in Yerushalayim. Maaser Sheni. Now there are two conditions for eating Maaser Sheni. Number one, it can only be eaten in Yerushalayim. And number two, it has to be eaten in a state of tahara. A person who's tamei can't eat Maaser Sheni. And therefore, says Reb Velbel, when we say Uvenei Yerushalayim Rakodesh, so we're all the things that can only be done in Yerushalayim, Valeinu Socha, and let us eat from its fruit. But the question was, that's it? Do you want to eat from the fruit? Don't you want to do mitzvahs? Says the Bible, of course you want to do mitzvahs. Eating Maaser Sheni in Yerushalayim is a mitzvah. The fruits of Yerushalayim is a mitzvah. And moreover, unverechecha aleha b'kedusha uvetara. Attendant to eating Maaser Sheni are two conditions of Kedusha and Tara. Kedusha, it's got to be on the holy site of Yerushalayim, but Tara, it's got to be in a state of Tara. So the whole bracha now looks different once Reb Velbel has taken a look at it. But the final comment that I wanted to make with regards to this problem identified by the smag, to eat the fruit of Eretz Yisrael, lechel mipriya, that's... Is that a value? the fruit of Eretz Yisrael? One of those who responded quite strongly to this question is the Bach. The Bais Chadosh, in his commentary on the Tur, in Or HaChaim Siman Reish Ches. And the Bach is actually astounded at the question. Tema, he begins. I'm in wonderment that anyone could ask this question. How so? Because, and just read a few lines from the Bach, the fruits of Israel will never look the same. Halo kedushas ha'aretz, the sanctity of the land. Hanishbas b'mikedushas ha'aretz ha'alyona, which comes from the higher realms, parallel spiritual realms of Israel. Hinishbas gam b'peruseha. That sanctity finds its way into the fruit of the land. If the land is holy, the fruit of the land is holy. Sheyon kimikdushas hashchina hashochenes bekerav haaretz. It draws from the sanctity of the divine presence that lives in the land, that dwells in the land. And that's why, says the Bach, ki al kein hizhir ba'omar b'sof parshas maseh. That's why it says, and this brings us to Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Lamed Dalet, V'lo setameh haaretz. Do not allow the land to become contaminated. Asher etem yoshvim bar, that you dwell there. Asher ani shochein b'socha, for I dwell in the land. And the pasuk concludes, ki ani Hashem shochein b'soch b'nei Yisrael. When I dwell in the land, ultimately I will dwell amongst the b'nei Yisrael. Why? Because if the Shekhinah is in the land, and the b'nei Yisrael are sustained by the land, the Shekhinah will come to rest within b'nei Yisrael. It comes through Peiros Ha'aretz. Im Tetamues Ha'aretz, if you contaminate the land, Nimsheches HaTuma Gam BePeiroseha, that Tuma will also then find its way into the fruit that comes in from the ground. Hayon Kimimena, that draws from it. Hukvar Nistalka Shekhinah. And then the Shekhinah goes away. That's why it's of the essence. The Pasuk says, don't contaminate the land. Because says the Shekhinah dwells in the land, and it dwells in the B'nai Yisrael. But if it's not in the land, it won't be in the B'nai Yisrael there. And therefore, when U Acharei HaDvar Me'ele, says the Bach, should you say to me, should you ask, is it correct, is it a worthy goal to say, bring us back to Eretz Yisrael, V'nuchal Mirpirya? Really, the answer will be yes, if we're interested in having the Shekhinah sustain us and be a part of us, and that will come through eating the pears of Eretz Yisrael. Yes, that is indeed a very worthy goal. That's a very high ideal. And therefore, says the Bach, we certainly do say these words, but it's such a different perspective. All of a sudden, the fruits of Eretz Yisrael, they draw from the Kedush of Eretz Yisrael, and when we consume them, we also are sustained by that Kedusha. It's an amazing element of the relationship between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. Certainly a worthwhile topic to conclude on this evening. We'll leave it over there. And next week, Mitzvah Hashem, there will be a shiur, will be the final shiur this week.